Welcome into the KSRO Kitchen. I'm Steve Garner, celebrating 30 years of bringing you the best in food and beverages from not only locally here in beautiful Sonoma County, but around the country and the world. My co-host is Chef John Ash. Good morning, Chef John.
Good morning. How are you? Can you believe 30 years? And we haven't changed a bit.
We haven't. Everyone else has out there. It's wonderful to be here in the KSRO Kitchen this morning. And today I thought we would kind of focus on foods in and along the Pacific Coast, going from south and to north, with a stop in Sebastopol along the way.
Yeah, well, it's along the Pacific.
It is, technically. Yeah. Yeah. To talk to a three-time Gravenstein apple pie-making champion. Yeah. But we're going to start our tour down south, down Baja way in Southern California and San Diego by welcoming Scott Koenig to the show this morning. Scott, welcome to the Good Food Hour this morning. I'm Steve Garner. Nice to meet you.
Hey, Steve. Nice to meet you as well.
And I believe you know this guy, Chef John Ash.
I just had the pleasure of meeting the chef about a week ago at Sabor de Baja in Rosarito Beach, Baja, California. Yes. Hi, John.
Hi, Scott. How are you? So would you tell our listeners what Sabor de Baja is?
Sabor de Baja is one of the premier culinary events in Baja, California, which actually has quite a few culinary events, so that's saying something. It's an all-white attire affair at the Rosarito Beach Hotel. It's held by my good friends, Chef Bo Bandana and her husband, Dennis Sine, and it's an annual event where everybody dresses up in white, and they come to taste the food of 20-plus chefs in the region of Baja, California, and their dishes that are paired with various wines and craft beers from the region as well.
I think a lot of people don't know, especially up here, are kind of unaware of Mexican wines and kind of what's happened to that industry in the last decade or so. Can you sketch it out a little bit?
Yeah, I sure can. Wine has been around in one form or another in the Valle de Guadalupe, which is one of Baja California's five wine valleys since the 1600s, since the Spanish came. But it's really only in the past 10 to 20 years where some pioneers, we call them, predominantly Hugo de Acosta, Hans Backoff from Montigenique, and Dr. Victor Torres from Torres Alegre, brought European winemaking techniques from Italy, from France, from Spain to Baja California and really kind of boosted the level of the wine here from what was really kind of a table wine, a family-made table wine, to a product that resembles something closer to what you guys would have there in Sonoma.
So it's... It has grown so much. I mean, it's been fun for me to be able to go down to Baja and see where it was 5 years ago and where it is now. It's something like 150 wineries. Is that correct down there?
You know, that's what I hear, John, and that's everybody from LA Cheto, which is Mexico's largest producer of wine. Based in the Valle de Guadalupe. They produce a million cases a year, down to very small winemakers who just make enough for friends and family, even 100, 200 cases a year. So there's a wide range between those small winemakers and then the very large winemakers.
And for those who don't know, that you mentioned the Valle de Guadalupe, where these wineries are at, it's become a wine trail now. There are all of these wineries and all kinds of amazing restaurants and young chefs who are doing things. It's a real wine and food excursion.
It is. They call it the Ruta del Vino, the wine route. And in addition to a lot of really good and amazing wines, you have scenic views. The Valle is simply beautiful. And then, like you mentioned, John, you have both younger and some very well-established chefs who are doing a variety of different kinds of cuisine in the Valle de Guadalupe as well. And that ranges from Italian food to what you might want to consider as a Valle de Guadalupe food or Baja California cuisine, which is really a cuisine that makes the most of local ingredients. Baja is located between two seas. You've got the Pacific on the west, and then you've got the Sea of Cortez to the east. So there's typically an abundance of fresh seafood. You also have ranches and farms around the region where a lot of the chefs source their meat products. And then there's also a lot of produce. Many of the restaurants in the Valle de Guadalupe boast their own gardens or have a neighbor who has a garden. So when you eat in the Valle, you're going to get really good, really fresh, very local, and often very sustainable food.
So you took us to what you described, you and a bunch of your cohorts, a bunch of food writers, described as the best breakfast in the world. Can you describe?
Not in Mexico, not in North America.
No,
in the world.
And a little bit about how it got the in the world designation.
Sure. I belong to a, well, the organization is changing now, but I belong to an organization called Foodie Hub. And Foodie Hub, think of it as like a thinking man's Yelp. But instead of having everybody in the street giving their input, you've got over 250 of the world's top food writers and bloggers giving you their opinion. In my opinion, and when I was at Foodie Hub, Doña Stella's was the best breakfast in the world. And I haven't been all around the world, obviously, but I've had a lot of food. So I was happy to nominate her machaca and eggs for the best breakfast in the world. She won. We had a couple of people come down and test it to make sure I wasn't out of my mind, which I'm not. And I think, John, you could probably attest to that after eating with Estella. And she was awarded the best breakfast in the world in 2015. And that was great in and of itself. But what happened was that the press here in the border region, San Diego and Baja California, really picked up on that story, and they ran the heck out of it. And the next thing you know, Doña Stella had lines out the door on weekends for her breakfast because everybody wanted to try the best breakfast in the world. So she's expanded her, she actually has her kitchen and her restaurant is her home, which she's since expanded to accommodate the ever-growing tide of customers that are coming in.
It was so cool because you arranged to get us in the kitchen. We had a chef's table.
Yes, and you know what, John, that was the first time I'd eaten in the kitchen.
Oh.
I always heard about people eating in the kitchen and always wanted to try it myself. The day we went, there was, like a 45-minute wait,
yeah,
I think?
Yeah.
And I simply went in to say hi to Stella, and the next thing I know, she was clearing the table and then beckoning us to come in and eat. And that was quite the experience. I really enjoyed it, and I know you guys did, too.
Yeah, we did.
So where exactly would it be located in reference to Rosarito or Tijuana?
It's further south. It's about an hour and a half from the U.S.-Mexico border. It's actually closer to Ensenada. So if you went all the way down about an hour and a half drive into Ensenada, it's just to the east of Ensenada, a little bit, maybe 20 minutes inland in the valley.
And there's a large American retirement population in the area. Is that true?
Mostly in Rosarito Beach. There's quite a few expats living there. Ensenada has a smaller expat community. And the Valle de Guadalupe, the communities there, there's three small towns within the valley. And they're mostly Mexican, local Mexican populations, though a few wealthier expats have been looking for land there and may establish some sort of homesteads. We'll see what happens.
Scott, we should let people know what you do and how they can follow your adventures and travels and recommendations.
Sure, John. I started blogging and writing about food and culture in Mexico about 5 years ago as a gringo in Mexico. And you can find my my blog at agringoinmexico.com. You can also follow me on Instagram or Facebook at agringoinmexico. And then I write for various other publications, too. If you follow my Facebook page, you'll see some of those pop up from time to time.
Do you lead food tours?
You know, I do, sporadically. In fact, I'm here in San Diego today. My wife is actually leading a food tour down through Tecate into the Valle de Guadalupe over this weekend.
Last time I was in Rosarito Beach was 1994.
Oh, wow.
And it was not what you're describing on this radio show today.
No. You know, and Rosarito Beach is still a fairly sleepy little resort town.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's some good food there, I don't know that it's at least gotten the attention that Tijuana to the north and Ensenada and the Valle de Guadalupe to the south have gotten. But things are happening there. But for the most part, it's still pretty much the same as when I started going down there, which was around the same time in the early to mid-90s.
And I'm still a little unclear. The Valle de Guadalupe, what area is this? I can't picture this.
Yeah. It's in the it's in Ensenada, so it's actually part of that jurisdiction or whatever you'd call it, the municipality of Ensenada. So you go south from Rosarito about an hour, and you hit Ensenada, which is right on the coast. And then the Valle de Guadalupe is about 20 minutes due east.
Okay. Wow. It sounds like a real destination that I should check out.
It's fantastic.
And it's one that Americans don't know about, don't you find, although they're discovering it.
Yeah, I mean, the first reaction you always get is there's wine in Mexico, because historically when you think about alcoholic beverages in Mexico, you think, number one, probably tequila, number two, beer. You might even think of a couple of other distilled spirits before you think of wine, but it is in Mexico, and the Valle de Guadalupe produces 90% of all the wine sold throughout the country.
That's just remarkable. For the Dona Estelio restaurant, you can't make reservations. You just need to go and stand in line for a bit.
You do.
Okay.
I would recommend if you're going to the Valle de Guadalupe, they see a dearth of visitors during the week. So if you really want to go and try everything, don't go on a Tuesday because most of the restaurants close on a Tuesday. But if you're there on a Monday, a Wednesday, a Thursday, or a Friday, you can just skip right into Doña Estela's, and there's usually not a line unless there's an event going on during the season. But, yeah, on the weekends, you're going to stand in line probably half hour to 45 minutes on average. But, man, it's so worth the wait.
Mm. And was there a theme for the culinary event this year? Because, John, you judged dishes.
Yeah, both Scott and I were judges for this event. And it was interesting. The requirement, what we were looking for, was not the best food from the 25 or so young Mexican chefs that were there, or even the best wine, but the best food and wine pairing, so there was some really wonderful food, but maybe the wine didn't work so well with it, and vice versa. But it blew my mind. I didn't expect it to be quite as organized and quite as much fun as it was.
And do these wineries have tasting rooms, or do a number of them have tasting rooms? Yes.
They do.
Yeah, most of them do. And they range from, like a rustic shack to a very elaborate underground wine cave. So you get the full range of experience when you go. When we do our tours, we like to take people to a larger winery, a mid-size winery, and then a smaller boutique winery to kind of give them a feel for the range of what's available there in the Valle de Guadalupe.
Well, this is great because you've opened my eyes to a whole new region of Mexico that I think myself and maybe others just kind of fly over on their way to other areas of Mexico. So thank you for this. And reminding folks to learn more, your website is agringoinmexico.com, and it's Scott Koenig. Thank you so much, Scott. This has been great talking with you this morning, and I have a new appreciation for this area of Mexico.
Excellent. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. It was my pleasure. And, John, I hope to see you down here again soon.
Yes, me too.
Thanks, Scott.
All right.
We'll take a break. We'll come back, and we'll go from the Baja area to Sebastopol, California.
Yeah.
A region we're very familiar
with.
Yes, you're
right.
I'm Steve Gardner, along with Chef John Ash in the KSRO kitchen.
Weather every 10 minutes mornings, every 30 minutes all the time on FM News Talk Radio, 103.5 FM and 94.5 FM, KSRO.
Did you know the largest RV dealer in the North Bay is now celebrating 25 years in business, and they're right here in Petaluma? Reed's Trailer Sales on Old Redwood Highway in Petaluma has over 200 travel trailers, fifth wheels, and truck campers. Now is the time to make the best deals of the season, and Reed's will match any show deal on comparable models. Also, Reed's Trailer Sales is looking to consign your late model motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. Let our experts sell it for you. Reed's will get you top dollar and save you all the time and hassle. Or they can pay you cash on the spot. The largest RV dealer with over 25 years in business is right here in your own backyard. Reed's Trailer Sales in Petaluma. Call 792-9100 or on the web at reedsrv.com. Reed's Trailer Sales, now accepting consignments.
Reed's.
you should buy your trailer at Reeves. A fifth-wheel travel trailer or utility. You should buy your trailer at Reeves.
Reeves Trailer Sales.
The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market is bursting with wonderfully fresh local fruits and vegetables from your favorite farmers and ranchers. There's an abundance and wide variety of heirloom tomatoes, early girls, beefsteak, sun golds, and more. Don't miss this year's peaches, nectarines, pears, and apples. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market has artisan foods ranging from fabulous bread, olive oils, balsamic vinegar, marinades, and tea blends to hummus and handmade pastas. Browse the artisan area for handcrafted gifts. Start your day with friends at the market. They're here to greet you year-round, rain or shine, Wednesdays and Saturdays, 8:30 till 1 at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun. The market's Tomato Fest and Salsa Contest is Saturday, September 16th.
Tune in every Monday at noon for legal expert Charlie Cochran on KSRO's Ask the Expert Show. Charlie is a legal specialist in civil litigation and partner of Kornblum, Cochran, Erickson, and Harbison Law Firm in Santa Rosa. Charlie specializes in personal injury, civil trial litigation, and is California's super lawyer. That's every Monday at noon. Legal expert Charlie Cochran on 1350 AM and 103.5 FM KSRO.
Not available in all states.
Hey, Tracy, heard you started your own business.
Yep, a Reese and Irvy's frozen yogurt vending franchise. It's the latest revolution in healthy frozen yogurt. My robots...
Wait, your robots?
Yep, my robots deliver 7 flavors of delicious and healthy frozen yogurt to customers in high-traffic locations. And Reese and Irvy's provides everything we need to succeed.
And the robots do the work.
They work, so I don't have to.
How can I get my own robots?
Simply go to froyofranchising.com, enter promo code 1616, and submit your information. That's froyofranchising.com, promo code 1616.
KSRO, AM, FM, and online. Depend on it.
And before we head out to Sebastopol, any dining experiences when you were down in the Tijuana area you want to recommend, John?
Yeah, Tijuana, it's funny, having grown up kind of near the border, Tijuana was always kind of a rough town, not a place you want to, you know, you needed to be careful. Tijuana's become very cosmopolitan. There's some just beautiful sections of Tijuana. And one restaurant that, I don't know whether it's the best restaurant in Tijuana, but people say that, you know, it kind of is at the top, is Mission 19. This is Javier Plasencia's restaurant, which has gotten kudos from around the world. It's one of those places that if you're going to go to Mexico, I mean, even Mexico City and places like that, one of the stops is Mission 19, which was just fabulous.
I wish I had a drum roll sound effect, but I don't. So just pretend that I'm going to give you a drum roll on the microphone here. Because we are introducing...
That was good.
Thank you. Not only a one-time winner or a two-time winner, but a three-time winner for best Gravenstein apple pie at the annual Sebastopol Area Chamber of Commerce's Gravenstein Apple Pie Festival. And I have been privileged with being a judge for the past 17 years at the festival. And it's almost unprecedented to have someone win this contest 3 years out of the last 6 years.
Has there ever been a three-time winner?
There was a family that starting about 20 years ago used to come in from Folsom, and the mom, the dad, the kids, and then even the grandkids started baking pies. And so help me, probably for 5 to 6 years, one of this family won the Apple Pie Festival almost every year. It was almost a lock that they were so talented, but they've since not been participating. But in their place, Carolyn Bowen has risen to the top as just the world-class apple pie maker. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning. I'm blushing.
Oh, well, it was remarkable. I first met you in 2012 because in 2011, your Mama Bear's Gravenstein apple pie was the best pie that we judged that year, and we gave you awards on the stage, and then we had you on the following year in 2012.
That's right.
And you brought your recipe, which I have in front of me, by the way, and which we're going to look at.
Oh.
And then the next year, what was the next year you won the festival?
The next year was 2015.
That's what I wrote down, and that was the salted caramel Gravenstein apple pie.
That's correct.
And then this past August 12th, what was the tweak on the pie this past August?
Well, this year, kind of in a nod to the theme of the fair with the honeybees and the honey, Sonoma County honey, I kind of tweaked the recipe, and it was honey and brown sugar Gravenstein apple pie.
So you've kind of you've done a basic tweak on the filling every year, haven't you?
Yes.
And the first year, the 2011, your sweetener was pure maple syrup and some brown sugar. And then into the salted caramel Gravenstein apple pie in 2015, it was obviously a caramel sauce. And then this year, in honor of the honey theme of the Gravenstein, you used honey along with brown sugar, correct?
That's right.
Okay.
But the same crust.
Yes.
All years.
Yes. Yeah, that you don't mess with the crust. Yeah, I'm happy with that.
Well, we got to remember, folks that are listening, these tastings are done blind. We don't know who is submitting a pie. So we tasted about 35, 36 pies. And once again, for the third year, Carolyn, your pie was the unanimous winner of all three judges.
So tell our listeners, though, what you divine something, because it was like, I've tasted this before when you tasted this year's pie. And I think it was the crust, probably.
Yeah, it's the crust. Yeah. And so the recipe is nothing that you would say, oh, here it is. It's flour, it's salt, it's unsalted butter, it's vegetable shortening, and water. Well, there's a million pie crust recipes that have those identical ingredients. So what is it, Carolyn? Is it in the fingertips? Is it the way you blend it? Walk us through your assembly of the crust.
I have kind of an odd view of making pie crust. It's almost like you go into it as a match with the pie crust, because as we know, pie crust can be very temperamental. And you kind of have to go in there with your swag and be a little loose and go, okay, Chris, I gotcha. And it's really all in how you handle it, I believe. And it's that ice cold water helps too. The less you handle it, the better. And just, you know, get her done and get her done as quick as you can. And that's usually how it works.
But do you blend this with a fork how do you blend the ingredients?
Yep. I'm a food processor.
Food processor.
Food processor kind of gal. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And so
I like that because you can do it so quickly.
Okay, so in the food processor, and then you just basically pulse it together. You add your ice water, process the ball. Okay, remove it, divide it in half, wrap it in plastic, chill in the refrigerator, 30 minutes. That still doesn't tell us, because millions of people do this, and their pie crusts are really tough. They're really brittle.
I wish I could say. I have to give kudos to this recipe came from a very dear, dear friend of mine who is from Fort Wayne, Indiana. And it was her mom. And I was at lunch with her one day at her home in Kenwood, and she made an apple pie. And I was like, that is the crust I'm trying to achieve. And so she wrote it down on a little index card, and I tried it, and it's just always worked for me. I could not tell you.
Okay. I mean, you're always looking for secrets, but there really are no secrets. It's repetition.
Yeah, I don't know. It must be the way it's the combination. I think it has something to do with the chilling the dough and then also the ice cold. I get it ice cold.
There's another reason, too. Did you know this? Because you're a nice person.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm going to have to share that with a few people who maybe don't understand that then.
Well, you give a half cup of unsalted butter and a third a cup of vegetable shortening. Do you cut these in fine slices? How do you cut up the butter and shortening?
Well, that's a good point. Both are in the refrigerator. They chilled until right before we use them. And I use a sharp knife and cut them and dice them. I just kind of dice them into small cubes. And then I, as much as I cannot touch them and warm them up, then they go right into the food processor and then pulse.
Okay.
So again, it's not handling it. Handling it is, and I saw that on Martha Stewart one time, that the least amount of warming and handling of your pie crust, the better.
Okay.
Yeah, I think if you're going to be a pie crust maker, you have to have cold hands.
Yeah.
You know, not too hot.
And make, mine cans are not cold.
Yeah, but it's that you work quickly, I'm sure.
Yes, that's it.
Well, we look forward to next August having you bring us a pie live at the Gravenstein. Because this is our tradition. John and I always invite the previous year's winner to sit in with us. And this next year, we'll be tasting your salted, not the salted one, but the honey and brown sugar Gravenstein Apple Pie Festival next August. Yeah. Are you going to enter again and try for a fourth time?
You know, I think three is a good retirement number.
Okay.
And I mean, that's just going to put way too much pressure on me. So, yeah, I'm going to go out on top, I hope. So, and that was my first lattice crust that I entered, and it turned out really well. So I think I'm just going to leave it at that success.
Okay, well, then we'll see you next August.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Carol and Bowen, for gracing our airwaves this morning.
And thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We'll end our show up in Seattle as we unravel the mysteries of the razor clam.
Wow.
I know.
And you have some familial connection to this, too, huh?
I do. That, when we return, it's the KS Arto Good Food Hour. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash.
FM News Talk Radio, North County 103.5, South County 94.5, KSRO.
The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market is bursting with wonderfully fresh local fruits and vegetables from your favorite farmers and ranchers. There's an abundance and wide variety of heirloom tomatoes, early girls, beefsteak, sun golds, and more. Don't miss this year's peaches, nectarines, pears, and apples. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market has artisan foods ranging from fabulous bread, olive oils, balsamic vinegar, marinades, and tea blends to hummus and handmade pastas. Browse the artisan area for handcrafted gifts. Start your day with friends at the market. They're here to greet you year-round, rain or shine, Wednesdays and Saturdays, 8:30 till 1 at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun. The market's Tomato Fest and Salsa Contest is Saturday, September 16th.
Hi, Jeff Davis here from On the Wine Road with my latest tale of traveling on the road with the 2017 Volvo S90 all-wheel drive T6 inscription sedan from Smothers European Volvo. Aside from the elegant wood trim and stylish leather seats, one of the most unique features in the interior is the center infotainment screen, which is much like a large tablet. As you swipe among its screens, you control almost everything in the car. As a matter of fact, there's only a thin strip of buttons below the screen. And like a tablet, you can swipe to the left and to the right and drag from the top and from the bottom to navigate through all of the menus. The screen is within easy reach of the front seats, and the amount of controls at your fingertips is pretty amazing. As Volvo says, it's a luxury sedan for a new world. If you'd like to take a glimpse into this new world, visit Smothers European Volvo, 2881 Corby Avenue, and smotherseuropeanvolvo.com.
Earnings vary based on your effort.
Do you want to learn how to make money flipping houses right here in the North Bay area? If so, we have an amazing opportunity for you. We're looking for a small group of motivated individuals to join our real estate investing team. You'll learn our simple three-step system for flipping homes right here in the local area. This is Than Merrill, star of A&E's hit TV show Flip This House. My team and I are looking for a handful of people in the North Bay area who want to learn how to make money flipping houses in your spare time using other people's money. The North Bay area is a perfect market for my system, and next week I'm holding a free 2-hour educational workshop where you will learn how to make money flipping homes and how to build long-term wealth with income properties.
To get 2 free tickets to Than's workshop, call 1-800-762-11. Seating is extremely limited. Call in the next 10 minutes and you'll also reserve a free copy of Than's Money for Deals guide. That's 1-800-762-11. That's 1-800-762-11.
Shift to the west by Hurricane Irma, and now people along Florida's Gulf Coast are scrambling for shelters. ABC's David Muir is on Interstate 75, where some are now trying to leave.
Those outer bands of this unprecedented storm starting to be felt. About 6 million Floridians ordered to evacuate as Irma closes in. States of emergency not only in this state, but in Georgia and South Carolina as well. Already some 30,000 people reported without power, and points south still bracing for a pounding from this hurricane. The Keys, it's going to be catastrophic. catastrophic, they believe, and in South Florida and Miami, the storm surge a real concern.
Irma could hit the Keys by tomorrow morning and Naples, Florida, by Sunday evening. Governor Rick Scott says more than 50,000 Floridians have taken shelter, and there's still room for more.
Currently, there are more than 260 shelters open across the state in every county in the state. At least 70 more shelters are opening today.
He's now putting out the call for nurses. Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Sonoma County's most accurate, dependable forecast with KSRO's Daniel Trucios.
Cool temps today with a warmer couple of days ahead. Today, sunny skies at 84, 67 on the coast. Clear skies tonight, low 58, 57 in Bodega Bay. Blue skies for Sunday at 94, 76 on the coastline. Monday, partly cloudy at 90 degrees, 75 on the coast. Depend on weather every 30 minutes on FM News Talk 103.5 at 94.5 KSRO.
It's the KSRO Good Food Hour. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash. And our next guest as we move up the coast is in Seattle. David Berger has worked as arts critic for the Seattle Times, executive director of a botanical garden, and communications officer affiliated with a World Heritage site on the Silk Road in China. He's the recipient of a MedCAF Fellowship for Marine and Environmental Reporting, and his work has appeared in the Portland Oregonian, Travel and Leisure Magazine, and Black Earth Institute Literary Journal. His new book, The Dedication, reads to my parents, to whom I owe so much, and to my wife, Karen, the big clam in my life. Now, you couldn't think of a more endearing dedication than that. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Nice to meet you again on the phone, and my co-host, Chef John Ash. I don't think you've met John.
No, before. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I've got your photo up on the website, so I feel like I'm talking to you.
Oh, great. We'll be animated.
Your new book, which we received about a week and a half ago, called Razor Clams, Buried Treasure of the Pacific Northwest, is that actually being released this week?
Yes, that's correct. It's in bookstores now.
And it's published by, is it the University of Washington Press?
Yeah, that's correct. That's the press associated with the University of Washington here in Seattle.
Well, I knew absolutely nothing about razor clams, although years ago I did go out clamming a few times, and it was way too much work for me. I gave up. And I'd heard of razor clams. I'd never tasted razor clams. And I, of course, talked to John, and he knows everything about seafood there is to know. But this book was absolutely delightful to read. Not only did I learn so much, but I laughed a lot at some of the wonderful photos of the clam festivals and Miss Clam and the history involved.
Clam sculptures, and it went on and on. It's so interesting that down here, we have razor clams on our California coast, don't we?
Absolutely, you do. You have clams mostly on the northern part in Humboldt and Del Norte.
Yeah, up in Eureka and Crescent City, I think there's some clamming activity. And then, of course, up the Oregon coast. But is Washington kind of the epicenter for the West Coast razor clam industry?
Washington kind of is. We have 53 miles of perfect habitat for razor clams, which is sandy coastal beaches. They're only found on the coastal beaches. That's a mistake people sometimes make. They think maybe they're in some of the inland bays where you also find hard shell clams or gooey ducks or some of the other shellfish, but never found in those inland waters, only right on the coast where the Pacific Ocean crashes with the waves and the wind blows in.
When did the razor clam bug hit you?
Well, when I first moved out here, it's been about 30 years now. Yikes. And I'd kind of heard about razor clamming, but wasn't really involved in it. And just kind of out of, curiosity, I went to the coast. And I happened to have bought what they call a razor clamming shovel. And this is looks basically like an ordinary shovel, except the blade is narrow. And I had bought it at a garage sale, thinking I might use it in the garden to transplant plants or something. So I went to the coast, and it was a morning dig, because you have to go during the low tides. And the low tide at that day was basically at dawn. So I got up at 4 in the morning. It was cold. It was dark. I traipsed to the beach. And when I arrived at the beach, I was absolutely shocked. There were like hundreds of people stretched north and south on the beach, and they all had headlamps and lanterns, which were bobbing around in the darkness like fireflies. And I just was stunned. I had no idea that this activity was going on, or that it was such a phenomenon here in Washington State, basically attracting thousands and thousands of people during a clam opening day.
And was this a true temper clam shovel, one of the classics that you were able to procure?
No, this was a rusted, ordinary clam gun or shovel.
And did you get any? Were you successful in getting any clams?
Not very successful. I have to say, I didn't know what I was doing. At that time, really, there were no websites to go to or whatever. And I accosted two older people on the beach, and I said, well, how do you do this? They looked at each other, and you could tell they didn't want to really talk to me. And the man wandered on, and the woman stayed behind and gave me a few pointers. And you look for a certain kind of hole or dimple, and then you dig. And there were holes right at my feet, and I said, well, like these holes? No, they said, not these holes. You have to go down, way down by the surf. Well, I dug holes for 3 hours that day and didn't get one clam until the very, very end, when I thought, well, maybe these clams are much deeper in the sand than I thought. And so after I dug my hole, I put my hand in the hole and, like, went deeper and deeper until I was basically up to my shoulder. I reached around. I felt the very tip of something hard. I thought, oh, my God, could that be the clam? And I pinched it with my fingernails. They're kind of an elongated oval shape, and they're in the ground vertically. So I had just pinched the very top of this elongated vertical shell. I pinched and started to pull upwards. I can remember the shock to this day. The clam started to pull downwards. And we had a little tug of war in the sand as I was pulling up and the clam was pulling down. It was hard work. It was a battle of wills, essentially. And I pulled it up, and then there was this large golden clam, and I was hooked.
And you have clams in your freezer right now?
We do have clams in our freezer right now. So they freeze fairly well. Mm-hmm. So
they're the most odd-looking creatures. They have no head. They have this tube, this digging tube. They're just really strange. It's one of those things that always begs the question, who was the first person to eat a razor clam?
Well, it was probably one of the Native American tribes here, since it was a food staple for them for so many years. Hundreds or thousands of years even before the white man came. But I have to beg with you, they are strange looking. And with the long neck and the powerful foot, the long neck coming out of the one end and the foot out the other. But I happen to think they're really beautiful looking. I mean, they have that beautiful streamlined shape. They're very geometric. And then they have the shell has an outer covering, which is very shiny and glossy. That helps the clam move up and down in the sand column. Because unlike most shellfish, which usually just stay there kind of inert, like an oyster or a clam inert in the mud or inert in the gravel, these clams travel up and down in the sand column.
So you're a confirmed shoveler.
I am a confirmed shoveler.
Yeah, you don't go in for the tube.
Well, no, I'm not. I'm not ideological. I will use the tube.
Uh-huh.
I will use the tube. There, those two. Just for your guests, there are two main ways of catching the razor clam. You can catch it with a shovel, and that has one set of postures and behaviors on the beach. Or you can go after them with the tube, which has another set of postures and places on the beach where you use them. The tube is usually used in the upper sand where the sand is a little drier, and the shovel is used where the sand is a little wetter, usually down by the surf zone, and usually you're wearing waders because you'll be in the water. And so they're two different clans, as I call them in the book.
Well, it was an amazing historical investigation that you did, tracking down the inventor of the first tube back in the 1950s into the 1960s, the improvements in the tube itself, and Mr. Barstone, who retailed his invention as the sandpiper, the clam digger's sweetheart. And then the other people that tried to steal his invention, and it was remarkable, this the pull and the tug and the interest in developing a better way to capture these clams.
One of my goals as I'm talking about razor clams is to rescue that gentleman from the historical dustbin. He's completely unknown. And when I started asking around, where did the tube come from, nobody knew. And I was overjoyed the day I stumbled on the patent, which was completely by accident. Not by accident, but nobody knew, and no one even knew if it was patented. I called the patent office, but they really don't index. They haven't indexed patents before 1976, so you can't so easily do a word search. And they told me when I called the patent office in Washington, D.C., well, you have to go to this library there at the University of Washington and literally go through the books. And there's obviously tens of thousands of patents and shovels and all kinds of digging implements. And that didn't sound too appealing. But then it turned out it was indexed. Someone is indexing but not telling people that it is being indexed. So I did the keyword search, and up it popped. And I just basically started dancing around my office in joy.
There are 10 chapters in the book, and there's numerous recipes, everything you could ever envision doing with a razor clam, from chowders and from fritters, and then some more elaborate recipes featuring some of the best chefs in the Northwest. Did Mrs. Berger help in testing these recipes?
Yes, she did. She was my... let's say I was her right-hand person in the kitchen. So she was great, super helpful in helping me check all the recipes and develop them.
Yeah, Karen's Fry Mix. Some of these were her original recipes, too, in the book.
That is absolutely correct. Karen's Fry Mix and her clam dip. She grew up eating clam dip. Her parents moved around a lot. Her father had a job where he was transferred a lot. But every Friday night, they would make clam dip and watch television. And when she discovered razor clams and started making clam dip with the razor clam, which has this wonderful, rich, distinctive flavor, she was a very happy camper.
So it's fascinating. Was there, and is there still, a commercial market for razor clams? I mean, for those who may not want to go out and struggle to pull them out of the sand and all that stuff, you can buy them in the market, can't you? Frozen or canned?
To a limited, very limited extent. The commercial harvest in Washington is minuscule, and there is no commercial harvest in Oregon. There's a small commercial harvest up in Alaska. Some of that is frozen. And some of it is fresh. Actually, Costco occasionally, at least here in Washington State, will have the razor clams that are harvested in Alaska.
By the way, I'm holding in my hands, David, a frozen 2-pound package of Polly Creek, Alaska razor clams, which I purchased yesterday. And on the back, it says Polly Creek, Alaska is located on the uninhabited western shores of Cook Inlet, Alaska. Each clam's individually harvested with a shovel, one at a time, from this wild, pristine environment. The clams are flown in a single-engine plane to our processing facility by our Alaskan bush pilot. The clams arrive at our processing plant the same day they're harvested. Here, they're processed and packaged in our state-of-the-art facility. The beaches where the clams are harvested and certified by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. They're wild. They're sustainable. They're the queen of clams.
Well, you've got some razor clams there with some real pedigree.
So John and I are going to divide these up and dive into your book and start cooking in a bit.
I recommend it is just simple saute.
Okay, that's what we will do then.
I would definitely start out with a simple saute. See how you like them, whether you... I tend to like them definitely on the very, very rare side. because if you overcook them, like any clam, they can get tough. So you have to be very careful.
So how long would you cook them? So if you have the clam meat, it's just for a minute or two. Is that right?
Somewhat it depends on the size of the clams. I mean, clams can be very small or really quite large. Usually when you see them packaged commercially like that, they tend to try and harvest them at around 4 inches, and they try to make the clams that are in the package somewhat uniform in size. Okay. So the neck and the foot tend to cook a little differently. Personally, when I cook them, I separate the neck and the foot and cook them each to the required doneness, if you will. Really, for me, 30 seconds often is plenty.
Okay, that quick?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, David. When we come back, I want to talk a little, just a few minutes about the historical importance of the Quinault Indians and this food source, and then a few of your favorite recipes and a couple other things. And then we'll give away a copy of your book to a lucky listener. How's that sound when we come back?
Well, that sounds great.
All right, David Berger, our special guest today in the KS Arto Kitchen, razor clams, everything you ever wanted to know about this intriguing, delicious food. It's Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash in the KS Arto Kitchen.
Larkfield, here's FM News Talk Radio, KSRO, on Crystal Clear FM at 103.5.
Ah, Bodega Bay, the jewel of the Sonoma Coast. Right in the center of town sits the Inn at the Tides, featuring a beautiful hotel with magnificent gardens and views of the bay, and the Bayview Restaurant, serving authentic Italian cuisine.
Ingredients are all locally sourced and organic when available. Start with a Dungeness crab and avocado tower with tomato gazpacho drizzled with a citrus herb oil, or the grilled calamari over arugula salad topped with black olive tapenade dressing. Then try entrees like crab cioppino in a saffron tomato sauce and veal piccata. Or how about the grilled filet Hitchcock? A grilled filet mignon stuffed with Dungeness crab, demi-glace, and a béarnaise sauce. Vegan, vegetarian, and gluten-free customers are welcome too.
The Inn at the Tides. It's less than 30 minutes from Santa Rosa, but seems a world away. Go to innatthetides.com for more info.
The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market is bursting with wonderfully fresh local fruits and vegetables from your favorite farmers and ranchers. There's an abundance and wide variety of heirloom tomatoes, early girls, beefsteak, sun golds, and more. Don't miss this year's peaches, nectarines, pears, and apples. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market has artisan foods ranging from fabulous bread, olive oils, balsamic vinegar, marinades, and tea blends to hummus and handmade pastas. Browse the artisan area for handcrafted gifts. Start your day with friends at the market. They're here to greet you year-round, rain or shine, Wednesdays and Saturdays, 8:30 till 1 at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts. The Santa Rosa Original Certified Farmers Market, where it's always fresh, local, and fun. The market's Tomato Fest and Salsa Contest is Saturday, September 16th.
Earnings vary based on your effort.
Do you want to learn how to make money flipping houses right here in the North Bay Area? If so, we have an amazing opportunity for you. We're looking for a small group of motivated individuals to join our real estate investing team. You'll learn our simple three-step system for flipping homes right here in the local area. This is Than Merrill, star of A&E's hit TV show Flip This House. My team and I are looking for a handful of people in the North Bay Area who want to learn how to make money flipping houses in your spare time using other people's money. The North Bay Area is a perfect market for my system, and next week I'm holding a free 2-hour educational workshop where you will learn how to make money flipping homes and how to build long-term wealth with income properties.
To get 2 free tickets to Than's workshop, call 1-800-700-6211. Seating is extremely limited. Call in the next 10 minutes and you'll also reserve a free copy of Than's Money for Deals guide. That's 1-800-700-6211. That's 1-800-700-6211.
It's the KS Arto Good Food Hour with Steve Garner, Chef John Ash, and David Berger, author of Razor Clams, Buried Treasure of the Pacific Northwest, a book that's just coming out this this week. Look for the clam shovel on the cover of the book. That's how you identify. David, what's the easiest way for us to get copies of the book?
Well, your local bookstore should either have it or can easily order it, or certainly online.
Okay. I like the question and answer section that you include at the end. And I love the fact that you're lobbying for elementary school children to really write their legislators and nominate the razor clam as the state clam of Washington.
I hope they take that seriously. We have a state, just about everything else, a state tree, a state mammal, and we should have a state clam.
One of the recipes that...
There were a whole series of things. You have a kind of wicked sense of humor, which I really like. It was like, what also in the back was the comment about earthquake and tsunami risk while clamming. And your advice is, if you feel it, get to higher ground. It's like, oh, okay. That's good advice.
Well, he wanted to cover the whole gauntlet of... clamming.
I don't want any lawsuits coming back at me.
One of the recipes that jumped out at me, it looks like your wife inspired this, was coconut milk curry clams with basil.
Thank you for picking that one out. And when you would suggest I think about recipes, that's actually one that came to mind. Yeah, the coconut cream in there does a beautiful job of capturing the razor clam flavor and kind of making it spread out and just kind of delectable on the tongue.
There were razor clam festivals starting, as you mentioned, with beautiful black and white photos back in the 1940s. They came and went. There's razor clam sculptures. Are there still any razor clam festivals that the public can attend?
Actually, they're more vital than ever. There's two. Which is kind of amazing and goes to speak to how vital the tradition is here in the Washington state. So there are two. There's one at Ocean Shores, and there's one on Long Beach, in Long Beach on the Long Beach Peninsula. And they're both in the springtime. And the reason for that is the clams are at their prime then. They're fat with the spawn. And also the digs typically are in the daytime hours. That's when the best low tides are. So the clam festivals are in the spring.
Great. And there's accommodations in the area, motels and things?
Yeah, beautiful accommodations. They do workshops on how to dig, and there's other things going on. There's usually a razor clam chowder contest, which is a lot of fun. Grab your spoon and sample a dozen different chowder concoctions from area restaurants, and it's really a good time.
And there was also the fritter competition. Some of the local high schools, I understood, competed.
Yes, the culinary arts kids in the local high schools have been competing for the clam fritter trophy. That used to be a thing when the contest first started, rather when the festivals first started in the 1940s. They had a giant fritter cooking contest, just a giant fritter. They cooked one giant fritter in a huge giant fry pan, which is still on display. You may think that giant fry pans are rare, but actually it turns out that there's towns all over the world. They love to have and display giant cookware. I'm not sure what that's all about. Maybe that's something you could investigate.
It could be another book, David.
Yes, right.
That's remarkable. The book is just chock full of clam lore and clam recipes and lots of good cheer and tremendous scientific research. Mm-hmm. Really, I mean, scratch the surface if you want to look at it from a scientific point of view, and also the importance historically to the Quinault Indian tribe and other tribes too. Would you do us the honor of giving us your favorite number today, David, between 1 and 12?
I'll go with 11.
Caller number 11. You're going to make our producer work for this today. Caller number 11 at 636-1350 will win a copy of the brand new Razor Clams, Buried Treasure of the Pacific Northwest, written by David Berger. His last name spelled B-E-R-G-E-R. It was delightful talking with you, David. When I'm up in the Seattle area, I hope we can get together and cook up a mess of clams. And John had something interesting to say about chowders. Is it too easy to overcook the razor clam? Is it better to just saute them?
Well, obviously different people have different ideas about how to do it. This is a different clam and cooks differently than a hard shell clam, which you would typically steam and get that delectable juice collecting at the bottom. So many people, myself included, like to add the clams just at the last moment after you've made the chowder and just dump in a bunch of chopped clams. Other people like to mince them up pretty fine and cook them in the chowder for a couple of minutes. But somehow also when you chop them up and mince them like that, if you end up cooking it for 5 minutes or 6 minutes, it's okay.
Okay. Thank you for giving us that papal dispensation that we're not going to do it. Mortal sin by overcooking them. Well, I hope the book sells like hotcakes. Thanks for writing it. It was great fun, and hope to see you again.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thanks, David. We're back next week, and in the studio will be Marcy Smothers.
With a new book.
With a brand new book on the history of cooking in the Disney Empire, the Walt Disney Empire. Marcy Smothers, live in the KS Arnold Kitchen. Thank you, John.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We'll talk again next week. Clark Wolf at the table following the news. High noon at KS Arnold Santa Rosa. FM.